Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa. I'm your host, and today we're diving into something that might totally change how you think about stubborn belly fat. We're going to explore the connection between stress, cortisol, and belly fat. But more importantly, I'm going to give you practical science-based strategies that you can start implementing today to break your cycle. Let's start with the science because I know many of you, just like me, want to know the why before we get to the how. So, what exactly is that stress hormone that people keep talking about, cortisol? Well, it's produced by our adrenal glands, and really, it's not inherently bad at all. Obviously, so many or almost all processes in our body do have a specific function. So, cortisol, in fact, is essential for survival. It helps us regulate blood sugar, reduce inflammation, and gives us a burst of energy in stressful situations so that we react in a certain way. The problem is, our modern lives have turned what should be an acute short-term response into a chronic, always switched-on stress state. And when cortisol is chronically elevated, it becomes sort of a fat storing trigger, or basically incentivizes fat storing or fat storage, particularly around the midsection. So here's what's happening. When cortisol levels are chronically high, it tells your body to store belly fat because everything else, survival, responding to those stressors, has become more important, or the body views it as more important, and therefore it just wants to keep your organs safe. And where are the organs? Around our midsection, and we call that fat around there the visceral fat. It's actually the quote unquote dangerous fat that accumulates there and is associated with many negative health outcomes or risks. A fascinating study published in the Journal of Psychoendocrinology, published in 2020, followed over 400 adults and found that those with high cortisol levels had significantly more abdominal fat, so the distribution was just different, when controlling for overall body weight and diet quality and quantity. But it gets worse. Elevated cortisol also increases our appetite. So, particularly if we're not controlling for calories, not tracking calories, we're going to crave higher sugar foods or higher calorie foods. Have you ever noticed that when you're stressed, you're probably not necessarily craving grilled chicken breast or broccoli? No, you probably want cookies, chips, comfort foods, and so on. And so, of course, that makes it even worse. The frustrating part really is that cortisol also breaks down muscle tissue if it is chronically elevated. So not only are we storing more body fat, we're also losing the very tissue that helps us stay metabolically healthy or helps us quote unquote burn calories more efficiently. So it seems like your body really is working against you, but really it's just keeping you safe, and it is what has kept humanity alive for a very long amount of time. Now, of course, we're different, dealing with different stress levels these days, or stress exposures. And so today is definitely going to be about how to manage that better. But first, in a study, another study I want to share is from the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. In this study, it showed that people with chronic stress had up to 30% higher cortisol levels and stored significantly more abdominal fat compared to their less stressed counterparts, even when calorie intake was similar. So, again, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that calories don't matter. People that listen to this podcast know very well how much of a calorie tracking fan I am. It also doesn't mean that you can eat whatever as long as you manage your stress. What I'm really saying is that if you're doing everything right with your diet and exercise, but you're chronically stressed, you're really fighting an uphill battle that you might lose, or it's just gonna feel like, if you're trying to lose fat, it's gonna feel like kind of driving with the handbrake on, so a lot harder than it needs to be. So let's talk a little bit more about stress and good versus bad stress, because again, as I said, cortisol really is not inherently bad at all. And a lot of it also depends on how we view stress or how we perceive a certain stressor. So again, I want to make an important distinction because not all stress is created equal. There is such a thing as good stress, which we often call eustress, so EU stress. And it really is beneficial for your body and your goals, obviously. For example, working out. So this is a short-term manageable stress that often even comes with excitement, and we kind of feel like it's a challenge. Again, think of a great workout. You're placing a stressor on your body so that you actually improve. If you would never do that, you would either stay the same or actually regress in many aspects. So we're going to, if we want to get stronger, we need to place our body under stress. But how or when we actually grow slash improve is during the rest time. Another example might be if you're giving a presentation and you're well prepared for it. Yes, you're going to be nervous, but it eventually feels manageable and you feel accomplished afterwards. So again, this type of acute stress can actually boost our metabolism and temporarily improve the body's ability to handle future stressors, and we are building resilience. The problematic stress that we call distress is chronic, overwhelming, and feels unmanageable. This is the kind that keeps us up at night, makes us feel anxious throughout the day, and has us reaching for comfort foods. It's a stress that's sabotaging our body composition goals. The key difference really is the recovery in between. With good stress, your cortisol levels spike and then return to baseline quickly. With chronic stress, your cortisol levels stay elevated, and that's when all those negative effects on fat storage kick in. So, as we go through the strategies, remember, we're not trying to eliminate all stress from life. It's impossible and would not be healthy. We're trying to manage chronic stress and improve our body's ability to recover from acute stressors. Let me start with the less is more philosophy. One of the most important concepts that I really want to imprint on you. It's something I have been a big fan of for a long time, but when I read two books, one is called Essentialism by Greg McKeown, highly recommended, and the other one's called The One Thing by Gary Keller. As you can already kind of tell by the title, they both say that essentially we're doing too much. It's not about adding something else. It's not about yet having another to do. Yes, meditation is great. Yes, going for walks is great and all that. But really, in essence, it comes down to stripping back your life to the things that are really essential to you, or the one thing or a few things that you deem as the most necessary, and then just be radical about eliminating other stressors. We have sort of become addicted to busyness, to filling up our calendars with many things that we don't even question why they're on there. So, really, my first point of action for you would be to filter through your calendar and the things that bring you joy, and then just adding in the things that really need to be done. So, how many times have you said, I'm busy, or you even tell yourself like I'm so busy all the time, even just today probably. How many times have you felt even like proud of saying, oh, I'm so busy, no, I can't possibly do that. I'm so, and I used to be there. I really used to be there. I used to do the same thing and just always felt that the busier we are, the more important we are, sort of thing almost. But it's absolute nonsense. And people that, work 5 hours very efficiently or effectively and then do nothing or do what their heart desires often earn a lot more than people that work 14 hours. I learned that when you try to do everything, you end up doing nothing really particularly well, and stress usually skyrockets that way because we don't have the time for the things that we love doing. But if we focus on doing fewer things and doing them better, not only do we get better results, but our stress levels become a lot more manageable too. And because we do more things that we actually love, we perceive the stress as something positive. Now I really try to focus on, just the few non-negotiable things that I have. Let's just say going for walks, strength training, eating adequate protein and tracking my food, the non-negotiables that I have for work. And then the other things like, yes, I love meditation, but I might only do it 6 times a week instead of 7, and giving myself the flexibility. Or when someone is asking me, oh, could you help me with that? Of course, I always want to say yes. And it is a very good characteristic to have that helping, mindset. But sometimes it's also something where, yeah, does that really have to be done? Do you have to bake cupcakes for your daughter's soccer friend's mom's birthday or something like that? Probably not. yeah, another like sort of backing that up here is with a study that was published in the Journal of Health Psychology that found that people who practiced selective optimization, as they called that, so focusing on fewer goals but pursuing them more intensely, had lower cortisol levels and better overall health and goal outcomes compared to those who tried to pursue multiple goals simultaneously. So again, first practical takeaway, look at your current routine and schedule and ask yourself, what are the main things, the two, three things that give me 80% of my results? Focus on those, let go of the rest, or delegate, or just, limit it a bit more, at least for now, and then see how you feel afterwards, not just after a day, but like literally give it some time. The second point I'm going to call making time for stillness. People that have been following me for a while also will know that I am a big fan of just yeah, going for walks, meditation, and so on. But it's really also doing those things not always guided or like literally having more stillness so that you can hear your thoughts. So often we have great thoughts in the shower. So often we have great walks or great thoughts when the battery of our phone runs out and we're forced to not listen to a podcast or something like that. Stillness really is an activity that allows your nervous system to shift from sympathetic, so switched on dominance, to parasympathetic dominance, so the rest and digest mode. So when you're in parasympathetic mode, cortisol levels drop, digestion improves, and your body can actually focus on repair and recovery and not just survival. I'm going to share four practical examples of stillness that yeah have scientific backup actually. So meditation, as I mentioned, I think this really comes down to finding what works right for you. It doesn't have to be 20 minutes or half an hour. A study in the Journal of Health Psychology showed that even just 10 minutes of mindfulness meditation daily for 8 weeks reduced cortisol levels by an average of 23%. You don't need to become a monk. I'm pretty sure you even get benefits with 3 minutes or 5 minutes. So start with that. You can, of course, start with a guided meditation with an app, for example, Headspace, Calm, or so on, or listen to piano music. But even just silence or focusing on your breath is often a really, really good place to start. And the second one I've alluded to is walking, particularly in nature. It's probably one of my, or if not my favorite stress management tool. It doesn't feel like, yeah, you're still doing something, especially for people like myself that have a hard time sitting still. I find that even with a walk, I take about 5 minutes to actually get into the flow and to actually let myself, my thoughts wander, to let myself disconnect a bit from the day. And then it turns into kind of a meditation. So, a study published in the Environmental Science and Technology found that just 20 minutes of walking in a natural environment reduced cortisol levels more effectively than 20 minutes of walking in an urban environment, which, of course, still 20 minutes walking in an urban environment is better than no walking at all. But yeah, the Japanese, I call this forest bathing or Shinrin yoku, which is essentially just spending mindful time in nature. There really is something about nature, listening to nature sounds, feeling the wind, feeling the sun on your skin, on whatever it is. So the research does show that this nature exposure or forest bathing can reduce cortisol levels by up to 50% and boost immune function. The third tip that I'm going to give here is journaling. I always thought of journaling like just as something that little girls do when they grow up. And then maybe about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, when I first got into self-development work, I was like, it seems like all the high achievers are doing that. There is something about like brain dumping or writing out your manifestations, your goals, breaking them down. And I started doing that and really helped me also just free up my mind or gain more clarity on things. And having more clarity on things is one of the biggest reasons why we achieve things. Like a lot of people that live unhappy, unfulfilled lives don't live unhappy, unfulfilled lives because they wouldn't be able to achieve their goals. They have just never defined and set their goals really too clearly. A study in the Journal of Experimental Psychology found that people who wrote about their stressful experiences, or just in general, how they're going to handle something for just a few minutes a day for 5 days had significantly lower cortisol levels and better immune function once again. So you don't need to write a novel. I personally set myself a one-page minimum every day where I, and that's actually a combination of like gratitude. It is a combination of writing the future that I want to achieve in an it's already done sort of state. And yes, it also is often reflection of the previous day or things that are on my mind. And then the last one, which has become very popular more in recent years, is breath work. It's of course incredibly accessible because you can do it anywhere, anytime, even if you're in an argument. So when you're stressed, your breathing normally becomes shallow and rapid. And if we consciously slow down our breath and especially focus on the exhale, we can literally, quote unquote, hack our nervous system. There are so many different techniques. For example, box breathing. Another one here is the 4-7-8 technique. So if we inhale for four counts, hold for seven, exhale for eight, and do that 4 times. A study in the International Journal of Yoga found that this simple breathing pattern reduced cortisol levels by 25% after just one session. Huberman, for those of you listening to his podcast, he's a big advocate of the physiological sigh, and so am I actually, because the research also backs that one up a lot in saying that this is basically the quickest way to activate our vagus nerve, which is what turns on the parasympathetic nervous system. And the psychological or physiological sigh basically means you take a deep inhale through your nose as deep as you can, and then when you're at the top and you think you've already inhaled completely, you're going to take another breath in through the nose very briefly, and then you're going to exhale through your mouth for as long as you can. So basically it sounds like this. And yeah, even just doing that 3 to 5 times is supposed to really switch on the parasympathetic nervous system. The key with all of these practices, of course, is consistency. It's not about doing breath work for an hour once every month or, meditating once for an hour a week. It really becomes a lot more effective if you just do small stints every single day. Now, next, I want to talk about sleep, prioritizing sleep. It is also an incredibly, if not the most important factor. I know I've said this about all the other ones too. But it really isn't just about the hours of sleep that we're getting. It really is also about the quality and the time, because truly going to bed before midnight gives us generally so much better of a quality of sleep. And our sleep is also a good report card of like, or a good indication rather, of where our cortisol levels really are. If we're consistently waking up between 3 to 4 in the morning, this is a very good sign, excuse me, that there's something wrong with your hormone levels or that you have chronically elevated cortisol. So, yes, if you're listening to this, it could be your perimenopausal state, but it could also just be a high cortisol state all the time. Here's what happens when we don't get adequate sleep. Our cortisol levels can increase by up to 45 levels the next day, and a single night of poor night's sleep can disrupt our cortisol rhythm for up to 6 days. Let that one sink in. I think that is absolutely crazy. Unfortunately for me, as someone who, travels on a plane, sometimes red eye, like once a month or every 2 months, that one stung a lot because those nights often mean that I don't get any sleep at all, not just a bad night's sleep. And yeah, I was like, holy crap, it really ruins basically the entire next week. And then also, yeah, of course, affects my fat storage, my muscle metabolism, and all the things connected to that in the following days. So yes, again, it's not about the not just about the quantity of sleep, also the quality and the timing. As you might know, the cortisol levels naturally follow the circadian rhythm. They should be highest in the morning to help us wake up and gradually decrease throughout the day, reaching the lowest point around bedtime. When this is like always disrupted, or when we are experiencing chronically high cortisol and maybe adrenal issues, oftentimes people feel they enter a state which they call wired and tired. So pretty much before they go to sleep or in the evening, they're super like switched on. Or they might, no, you might, you are switched on, but you are tired, like you're fatigued, but you're switched on and you just cannot go to sleep. So yeah, sometimes we disrupt the rhythm again through travel, like in my case, or shift work, like also in the past in my case, or poor sleep, chronic stress, and that essentially also, so a disrupted circadian rhythm also often means that we have the quote unquote fat storage mechanism turned on, particularly around the midsection, once again, for the same reasons that I mentioned initially. A landmark study published in the American Journal of Epidemiology followed over 60,000 women for 16 years and found that those who slept less than 5 hours per night were 32% more likely to experience major weight gain and 15% more likely to become obese or even when aiming to control for diet and exercise. I don't know what specifically that means in 60,000 people, but yes, that was sort of the conclusion of that study. So, what do we want to do in order to get better quantity and quality of sleep? Of course, we want to keep a somewhat consistent sleep schedule, even on the weekends. A lot of people give themselves a jet lag every weekend because they suddenly think their bedtime goes out of the window. No, you don't need to be a monk once again and be super, super strict with your 9 o'clock bedtime or whatever it is, even on a Friday, but sort of somewhat within 1 hour or so of your usual wake and sleep time would still be good on the weekend. We want to develop a wind down routine that starts not just in the last hour before bed, but we want to avoid caffeine in the afternoon. It often has a half-life of 6 to 8 hours. So if you're going to go to sleep at 10, 2 o'clock should really be the very latest that you're having caffeine. Some people are even more sensitive and are probably best just to have coffee in the morning, if at all. We want to have a dark, quiet, cool bedroom. We want to see that our body temperature actually drops before we go to sleep. Sometimes, like sauna or so, can help with this, which sounds contrary, but if you heat the shell, then the body core temperature drops. And then, of course, especially in the hour before, or I would say 2 to 3 hours before, not doing any brain activity work, not answering any emails, dimming lights, avoiding screens, maybe doing some stretching, definitely not scrolling in bed. That's essentially what I'm saying. I again, if you've listened to this before or to my podcast before, you will know that I really, really always say if you wake up with your phone alarm, the very least you can do is put your phone on the other side of the bedroom so that you're really not even tempted to grab your thing first thing or last thing before you go to sleep. Ideally, it would be even better to keep the phone out of the bedroom. Just purchase a cheap alarm clock, which people have been using for decades. So don't come up with the thing, oh, what if it doesn't work one day? It's okay. You're gonna survive. Right. Okay, let's move on to the point of nutritional considerations and also supplements. Really, supplements should never just be the first thing to talk about. We do want to also ensure that we are eating enough, that we are, well, that's probably actually one of the biggest things when it comes to nutritional consideration. So the amount of calories, if you're in a calorie deficit, it's almost a given that your quality of sleep is going to decrease. And just the fact that you are in a calorie deficit is an extra stressor on your body. So that is also why we emphasize so much that we should not be in a calorie deficit for extended periods of times. This depends a lot on the current body fat levels that you have. If you have more body fat levels, you can be in a diet for longer or in a dieting phase for longer. But if you're already pretty lean, I always like to go by the rule of like no more than about a third of the year should be spent dieting at the very most. So that's point number one. Point number two is, of course, also macros, and we want to eat enough protein, but actually, for sleep and stress management, cortisol, carbs are also incredibly helpful, incredibly beneficial. That is also why, when we're stressed, we are craving more carbs. Of course, we should try to go for the healthy carbs first. We should try to go for the sweet potato, the rice, the oats, and which also soothe our nervous system and help our body manage the stress better and sleep better. And then, of course, we can talk more about food quality or timing as well, because we shouldn't eat a huge, huge, huge meal just before going to sleep. Your body's going to be busy digesting that and not resting up as well, therefore not able to deal with all the cortisol buildup from the day as well. But you also shouldn't go to bed super hungry. So this depends on what stage in your nutritional periodization you're at. It depends on how many meals you normally eat or you like to eat and your satiation levels and all of that. I can't really give a specific recommendation there. Of course, we also want to try to eat 80-90% whole foods, because that in and of itself will supply our body with more micronutrients and will keep us more satiated, generally speaking. And with that, it goes to probably goes without saying, but I am gonna say it. Alcohol is a stressor on your body. It's a toxin, and therefore your body is going to prioritize getting rid of the alcohol before it does anything else, and that includes before dealing with cortisol and or basically, yeah, it actually can, even though you might feel more relaxed, it is sort of a stressor on the body. It does mess with that too. So minimizing alcohol intake and other inflammatory foods, very sugar, like very, very high sugar intake, or a lot of processed foods, that should definitely be limited. On top of that, things like that are high in magnesium are very good to try and get more into, almonds, spinach, and all of that. But it is tough, especially for people that are physically active, to get enough magnesium just through food. And therefore, I almost always recommend supplementing with about 300 to 400 milligrams of magnesium glycinate or a magnesium blend. I have also done or put out a blog post on the various types of magnesium, because there's also magnesium malate, magnesium threonate, and so on, which also serve various purposes, or citrate if you want to take it more for digestion. So there are various kinds, but glycinate is really quite helpful. It's more like a blanket kind of magnesium to take that is often recommended. The other one that can help us deal with stress and therefore cortisol is ashwagandha, an adaptogen, which has been used by in sort of natural medicine for thousands of years. Like, literally, this is not an over exaggeration, but it has just become more popular in our Western world now, and it is showing a lot of promise, really. It seems to be able to reduce cortisol in chronically stressed people by up to 30%. Yeah, we should look for an ashwagandha that is with a standard, or that contains a standardized extract with at least 1.5% of withanolides or withanolides. I don't know how to pronounce that. Then omega-3 is probably the third one I would mention here, or I would recommend for nearly everybody. We should go for an omega-3 that is high in EPA and DHA. I don't recommend one which is just high in ALA, because ALA needs to be transcribed into EPA and DHA, and the transcription process is really, really inefficient by the body, and only about 15% of it actually, quote unquote, arrives where it should. So yes, let's go for one which is high in EPA and DHA, ideally about 1 to 2 grams of the combination of the two per day. From yeah, so that's really one, the three most important supplements that can help us deal with stress. Let me see, what else did I want to mention here? We should also try to keep our blood sugar levels steady, which kind of goes hand in hand with the macronutrients that I mentioned earlier, because when our blood sugar spikes too much or crashes too much throughout the day, it also sort of triggers a cortisol release. And if we prioritize protein at every or most meals and include some healthy fats and vegetables, so fiber, over just the simple sugars and processed foods, we can keep our blood sugar much more stable. And post-meal walks, postprandial walks, as they are called, are super helpful with that too. All right, so to wrap this up with your action steps, here is what I suggest for you to do. First point was to identify the biggest stressors and really eliminate the things that don't need to be done at all, streamline them or outsource things. The second one would be to choose one, just one stillness practice, whether that's going for a walk or meditating, and committing to it for just 5 minutes per day. Maybe if you go for a walk, could be a little bit longer, ideally. Or you can just sit in nature without going for a walk. Again, consistency is more important than duration. And then third one would be to audit your sleep hygiene. And also just pick one thing that you can improve. Maybe it means putting your phone in another room. Maybe it means, I don't know, doing brain dumping before you go to sleep, maybe going setting a consistent bedtime. And then the fourth one would be to look at your current like food routine and nutritional routine. Does my meal frequency and my, even also we could also include training in there actually. That is a big one because I actually could make a whole other episode about this. I haven't even touched on that. But if I dig into that now, it's gonna really take over because of course if we overtrain, if we train we'll train way too intensely, that's also gonna that would be a big modifiable factor too. But yeah, if we go way too deep here, that's gonna extend the episode even more. So yeah, let's just look at the current food routine and nutritional routine. Should I change my frequency? Should I change my macros? How long should I be in a deficit? If I'm in a deficit, when can I reverse out of it? And again, here also remembering that not we don't want to make or need to make too many changes at once. It often just comes better or is we can be more consistent if we just layer it one on top of the other. I guess I will throw in a training one here because the quicker after our training session, regardless of what you do, so we can talk about the what another time, but regardless of what you do, the quicker you can enter into your recovery phase after training, the better really. So something that is incredibly helpful is even just after your training, laying down. You can put your feet up the wall. That's even more helpful because that kind of brings the blood down to your heart. Taking a minute and do some deep breathing here. So we're almost habit stacking here, going back to the previous point of stillness practices. And yeah, just doing some deep breathing. You will notice that automatically your body and your brain go from that sympathetic switched on mode into wind down mode. And the sooner we do that, the sooner we're initiating the recovery process. I'm a huge fan of stretching post-training, not because stretching is showing or has shown to be so beneficial for recovery. For me, it's really just a way of telling my brain, okay, we're done exercising, now we are winding down. And also for a similar reason, I am a fan of eating something within an hour or two of training at least. Not because there is this whole protein metabolism window. No, total daily protein intake really matters the most, much more because that is another way for us to bring cortisol down. Every time we eat, we're lowering cortisol. This is why we're craving more foods when we're more stressed. So, yes, be patient with yourself. Cortisol patterns, stress patterns don't change overnight. Of course, it takes weeks of consistent stress management before we even see any kind of changes, but this is the way to help your body let go of stubborn belly fat, to help your body let go of that visceral fat. And really, it's not a reflection of willpower necessarily where you store your body fat. It might just be an indication of your hormone levels, and that also includes cortisol or chronic stress. So by addressing the root cause here, instead of just looking at the symptoms or thinking I need to cut my calories more or why am I just storing fat here, really think about what lifestyle practices you can do or might be the reason for that. So that's it. That's all for the episode that I have for you. Thank you so much for listening. Let me know if you liked this solo episode. As always, share it if you enjoyed it. And thank you so much for your time. I look forward to speaking to you soon.